Hey guys, welcome back to another week of Autastic, your comedian's guide to autism. I am one of your hosts, Kirk Smith, and here as always, my co-host and friend,
Graham K. Hello everybody, thanks so much for listening. Welcome back to another sode of Autastic. Kirk, we have an amazing episode lined up, don't we?
I'm excited. This is a special science episode. We did a series of interviews a year ago now. And Jill Escher, the science brain behind this operation.
Yes. she is the science wing arm of this operation. As you listeners know, we are not the science arm. We do try our best. And I think every once in a while, Jill just listens and gets frustrated and decides to go out and do interviews. She's like, "These guys, I can't take it anymore." And then she goes and conducts actual content heavy scientific interviews with scientists and people who raise money for science in the autism world, and we appreciate it. And we're gonna do like one a month, right? We're gonna release them once a month.
And researchers. This is a researcher. You can actually hear the moment on tape when Jill's frustration with us boils over.
Yes. She actually attacks us on her own podcast. And she's interviewing Alicia Holliday from the Autism Science Foundation, which you were about to listen to the interview. And she goes, Graham and Kirk stink at talking about science. And you know what? Alicia, I don't know you, but thank you. You came to our defense.
She stood up for us.
She stood up for it. She's like, no, they're good. They dumb it down. They just naturally dumb it down.
They have a gift for dumbing it down. A real dumb gift.
Yeah.
like they don't speak. Nope, not that kind of dumb. Different kind of dumb.
Nope. Yeah.
I do think it was funny. Like,
it's awesome. And it's well deserved. You know.
Fair enough. Yeah, listen, if you live in glass houses, you shouldn't throw stones. But if you actually are a science research funder...
I don't even know what that means. You'll have to explain it to me off the air.
I'm saying scientists can make fun of our lack of science. I'm down with that. That's totally fine. Yeah, if Jill wants to point out that we aren't good at this science part, she is in her 100% full rights. I thought she did a great job on this. I thought she did a Rover Report. It's a great job.
Yes. Yeah, Jill, excellent job. Thank you so much. Good interview. Before we get to the interview, I'm going to shoehorn this in. Everyone, go to patreon.com/autastic. Don't forget to donate a dollar per episode. That's all it takes. We appreciate it. If you feel like donating more, there are options to do that. That's how we do the podcast, patreon.com/autastic. And yeah, want to get to the interview?
Let's run this. Yeah, this is Alicia and the Science Foundation and the Autism Science Foundation, and Jill does a great job introing her. Let's just run this thing.
Yep, Alicia Holliday. Here we go.
Hey everyone, this is Jill Escher, roving reporter for the Autastic podcast, and I am here in New York City at the Autism Science Foundation with the Chief Science Officer of Autism Science Foundation, Dr. Alicia Holliday. Hi, Alicia.
Hi, Jill. Hi, everyone. It's really my honor and pleasure to be part of this podcast. I'm a listener, and I love the Autastic podcast, and I'm excited to be on it.
Well, we're excited to have you. Now, Alicia is also a podcaster, which we will talk about later. But Alicia, tell us a little bit about the Autism Science Foundation.
So the Autism Science Foundation, we're small. We were founded in 2009 by Allison Singer, who is the parent of a daughter with autism, and then she also has a brother with autism. The goal of the Autism Science Foundation is really to provide a niche, which is funding new researchers. So we fund good science, we won't fund bad science, but we also invest in research fellowships. So those...
What does that mean?
So like a young investigator, a pre-doc, so someone who's getting their PhD, or somebody who has their PhD and needs a little bit more training before they go off and become their own researcher. So we're funding both the scientific project and the we're supporting the person to stay an autism researcher and to learn about autism.
So you really want to encourage these young, bright minds to pursue careers in autism research,
absolutely,
right?
We want them, if they're great and they do a good job and they write a good application, we'll fund them, and we want them to stay. I mean, we want them to take their training through the Autism Science Foundation and go on and finish answering the questions that they started when they were pre-docs or post-docs, and we want them to stay and get... We also want them to become good autism researchers, not just scientists, but autism researchers, so they stay in the field.
Good, good. So basically you give grants.
We give grants.
Yeah, you don't do research yourself.
No, yeah. We don't do research ourselves. We have a small office in New York City. We support scientists to do the research.
Got it. Great. So when I met you, oh my gosh, how many years ago? I think it's got to be about 7 years ago now.
Yeah.
You had two twin daughters.
Yes.
Who are very adorable. And you had been in autism research for quite a long time, but little did you know that, lo and behold, one of your daughters would go on to be diagnosed on the spectrum. Can you share a little bit about them?
Yeah, so they were born in 2010, and we had noticed, you know, Sarah didn't walk until she was 2 years old, which, you know, I kept taking her to the doctor, and they kept saying, oh, they all walk eventually. Well, they don't really all walk eventually, but, and she also just didn't, she didn't respond to me the same way Jennifer did, so she was one of twins. They're two twin girls. They're now eight. And she wasn't really, you know, Jennifer would really get a kick out of a smile. She would love to be held. She was very gentle, whereas Sarah really wanted to be by herself. And frankly, that wasn't what really got me. What really got me was around three, she started having these really intense meltdowns. One story I can remember is we were in, it was one of those years where the polar vortex hit New Jersey. And so I was just rushing to get the girls, at the time they were still in preschool or even in nursery school, from the back door to the car with the car running and every, you know, like the whole thing, so we wouldn't have to be out in the cold. And in the process of that, I maybe skipped a step of our routine or changed what door they went in, and it would mess her up for the entire day.
Oh.
She would have a full-blown meltdown in the car. And then other times I would drive
red
home.
Red flag.
I would drive home and I would go a different, when they got older, a little bit older, I would go home a different way. And she didn't like that. Of course, she was too young to really express what that
meant.
And
at that point, were you starting to get suspicious that something was going on?
I actually wondered if she had OCD, right? Because it was the routine. She used to line things up. They weren't, you know, wheels on a car. They were more like dolls and shells and things. She used to line things up and get really upset if I cleaned them up, but, you know, she wasn't really telling me that she wanted me to leave them there. So, I really thought it was OCD. And so I guess the social part of it kind of left my mind. And she was doing some of the stimming. She was doing a lot of stimming behaviors, but that, my doctor had me convinced that she had, you know, she had a cyst, she had allergies, that's why she was rubbing her skin all the time. So at some point, my mother convinced me to take her in for a developmental evaluation, and I did, and I was lucky enough that because of the Autism Science Foundation, I had contacts. I was at Autism Speaks at the time, but I had contacts where I was able to get her in quickly, and I was really lucky about that. And I was lucky that, you know, I was educated enough to see the early signs. She's one of these kids that probably wouldn't have been diagnosed until much later, until she entered school, when teachers notice, you know, now if we have an explanation why she sits by herself at recess, why she doesn't make eye contact, we have those, they have that explanation, but a lot of girls and a lot of kids actually go through, and if they do okay academically, they don't really get picked up.
Right.
So,
yeah, and you say you had contacts. I do want to say, audience, that Alicia is one of the best known people in the entire autism research world. Everyone knows Alicia. Everyone respects her.
Oh, making me blush.
Oh, well, it's all true. It's all true. So let's talk about autism research, because let's face it, Kirk and Graham are not the most competent people at talking about research. What do you think?
I think they're great at talking about research. No, I think they are. They actually make things they simplify things in a way and in a humorous way that I really like. And so I think that it's really great. I mean, they talk about major findings, but talk about just the top line, which I appreciate. I like that.
Well, there is your new roving reporter, Alicia Halliday. You can fire me now. Okay, so let's talk about research and some of the things that are happening now that you think might be important for autism families down the line.
So I think that the first thing is that we have spent the last 15, 20 years studying children with autism, and we still need to. There's a lot we need to learn. But now that we know more about how autism emerges and what symptoms come up and when, we're able to have a better handle on understanding adults. And so that's what scientists are doing now, is trying to put some more understanding on why symptoms change over time, what are the strengths, what are the challenges, and what are the specific needs of people across the spectrum. And that's the other thing, is that scientists are starting to better identify groups of people with autism that share more similarities to each other than they do differences. So people with autism can be so drastically different. Can we put, you know, subgroup or put little groups together that show some similarities so we can start to better understand these groups and then better tailor interventions and services for them?
Absolutely. I'm a big fan of that concept. I don't want, you know, it's sort of when you look at somebody like Peter or JJ, you know, the autistic, most talked about people with autism on autistic. Yeah, they're very, very different. You know, they have this underlying similarity in the sense that they both have challenges with social communication and executive functioning, but their differences are vast, right?
Yes.
But that's true of this entire autism spectrum, and it really does muddy the research because you're throwing in people in the same pot who really might have very, very different things going on in terms of what's causing it, in terms of what's going on with their neurobiology, in terms of what the interventions might be, right? And we have to get a little bit more clear, I think, about these subgroups.
I think that you can talk about, like, when you're in a situation where you just want to help people, you can identify certain things in each person that they need help with. But when you do research to help large groups of people, it becomes harder and harder, right? So I can imagine being a therapist who's able to meet one-on-one with different families and say, okay, well, you need this type of help and you need this type of help, and being able to give it. But when you're talking about research and being able to understand for, you know, millions of people with autism, you need to have a way to better categorize people in a way that's going to help them, right? So the needs of people are vastly different, and I think that sometimes one type of service or intervention is not appropriate for another person.
Absolutely.
But when you mix them all together in the same study and you don't find an effect, because some people are high responders and some people are no responders, and then the whole thing just gets mixed up, you're missing the opportunity to help some people.
To find those high responders
because
they're mixed up. Yes, exactly.
Move on to the next intervention in the low responders.
Exactly, exactly. Well, let's hope we get there. So tell me about some of the findings recently that have really interested you, things that you know, might be relevant to families. Anything in the intervention world, anything in the causation world that has really grabbed your interest?
Yeah, so I think that in terms of interventions, I think the interventions were moving beyond what works and starting to understand that not one thing is going to work in everybody. So what scientists are now doing and clinicians are now doing is training different groups of people that have more interaction with those families and others. So it may be a parent, and I hate to put all this kind of pressure on parents as the people who provide the intervention, but that's one group.
Yeah, we're exhausted, Alicia.
Yeah,
don't ask us to do anything else. I'm not even picking up a pencil at this point.
community healthcare workers. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be in the Latino and Latina community. There are people in their community that are well known for providing healthcare, and if you can deliver the healthcare to those individuals, or you can deliver the training to those individuals, mm-hmm. then maybe they can pass it along. I think in terms of genetics, we're starting to know more and more about genetics, but what's becoming really interesting is that we're not only identifying these genes, these key genes, right? We're identifying different combinations of genes. And so we know that it's not just one or two genes, it's probably the right combination of about 100 genes. And that makes things like using genetics to help identify early very difficult, right? Because if there's 100 genes and they happen in different combinations. So I think that that says a lot about you know, the potential to look at genetics as a possible eugenics, right? So I don't think we're still 15 years later.
It's impossible. We aren't even close.
Well,
to
I think that there's a misnomer that's the reason why we look at genes is because.
I've seen that. That's crazy. Yeah. That would require a whole tangential topic here, but. You're talking to a genetic skeptic here mm-hmm. on the couch with you, and I think that right now, if an autism family goes into a clinic, has their kid's blood drawn, mm-hmm. that kid has like less than a 10% chance of having a genetic diagnosis.
Absolutely.
It's still very, very, very low,
yes.
right? And everyone still talks about autism as a genetic disorder, but I'm not seeing the data. Mm-hmm. Show me the data.
Exactly.
And then when I just met last week with a very esteemed autism geneticist here in New York, and he said, well, you know, maybe we'll get to 20%. You know, maybe we'll end up finding 20%.
Right.
Well, guess what, math whiz? That leaves 80%,
right.
you know, unexplained by genetics.
Right.
So I'm very passionate about gene-environment interactions
right.
and about other things. So I think genetics right now, although it's very, very important, mm-hmm. is of limited utility to our population.
I think gene-environment interactions are very important. I think, you know, it's silly to think, at least in my mind, that you can have environmental factors affecting, you know, heart disease, diabetes, ADHD, other sorts of mental illness like schizophrenia, but somehow autism is immune.
It's exempt,
that. It's exempt. And that we do have studies that show that there are environmental factors that increase the probability.
And I just talked to Dr. Alan Brown at Columbia, and he went over some of the things that epidemiology has found.
Right. So and interestingly enough, the environmental factors that we're finding are associated are things that we should be avoiding. Like being incredibly sick while you're pregnant. I would say, yeah.
Most people
moms
already
try
know that.
Not to get sick while you're pregnant. Air pollution. Well, we should all be doing a better job of making sure our air, we should.
And those findings are weak, by the way.
There's a lot of them, though. I mean, they're weak, but in the consistently right direction. They're not huge effects.
Okay, small effects.
Small effects. And then, you know, we do know, about some drugs taken during pregnancy.
We talked about valproic acid. Yeah, Depakote.
Mm-hmm. And then I also think that because of all this research that's better understanding people with autism, I'm seeing huge progress in services research, right? So I'm seeing studies that are actually examining the IEP process from a scientific perspective and looking at what goes wrong and what goes right in the typical IEP meeting and making recommendations about how to improve that between the parent and the teacher mm-hmm. and the school system. And so that's the more we know about people with autism, the more helpful services type research we can conduct.
Well, speaking of, now that we're talking about services instead of biology, one of the things that you and I definitely agree on is the fact that we are facing a growing adult mm-hmm. autism crisis
mm-hmm.
In terms of housing and lifespan services.
Mm-hmm.
And adults with autism have been a very ignored population. Mm-hmm. And frankly, it used to be a very small population, but now we're seeing
right.
rapidly surging numbers. What can the research world do to help improve prospects for this population that, you know, frankly, is going to be disabled their whole lives mm-hmm. and will need supports their whole lives.
So sadly, this work had just started, right? But I'm seeing work from people like Julie Lowndes Taylor and Marsha Malik. Marsha Malik has actually been in this for a while, but because she did a longitudinal study, the results weren't out until...
No jargon.
Okay, no.
People are
no.
like, what's a longitudinal study?
So unfortunately, it wasn't until just recently that we're really starting to better understand the needs of adults with autism mm-hmm. and those with varying degrees of disability or ability. So things like, you know, the fact that there's an incredibly pathetic employment rate. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the sort of thing that needs to be documented, and you can take steps to say, okay, now we know what the unemployment rate is in people with autism. Next step, what do we do to improve that? How can we make policy changes, and how can we make things better for employers mm-hmm. to employ people with ASD
across the spectrum? Yeah, very big issue.
And same thing with housing. I mean, what are the specific needs of people with autism in housing? And how do we make sure housing accommodates those? Mm-hmm. And so that we're not just...
Well, first of all, they need a lot of money.
They need money, yes.
Which they don't have. So,
and that's a huge debate. How much money if you have, say, let's just put it at $100 million for autism, and I'm sure it's more than that. How much do you put towards services? How much do you put towards things like building housing units? How much do you put towards scientific research? And that's mm-hmm. a huge question. And mm-hmm. everyone says, I need more money. And they do need more money. Mm-hmm. So it's, but it ends up becoming kind of, it ends up becoming a competition, right? Because the more money that one group gets, the less money that another part of the community doesn't get. Because there's just limited funding.
There sure is. There sure is. Yeah, and I want it all. I want research, and I want services, and I want housing. So, yeah, we all have to kind of work together towards our common goals, don't we? So I want to wrap it up, but is there anything that that you, like, any way that your normal family can get involved in autism research? Or, well, I do want you to share your podcast, right, about autism research. So share that. But any other ways, you know, your normal listener could get involved in autism research?
So please subscribe and even just listen to one or two episodes of the Autism Science Foundation Weekly Podcast.
It's hosted by Alicia Halliday, PhD.
It is very sciencey, but it's only about 10 minutes a week. And I definitely also solicit ideas for topics. So we try to touch on kind of new, interesting, exciting findings, but also go back and do maybe like a 10-minute summary. I want to do one on actually medical marijuana coming up.
So that's one of the favorite things in our house. Yes, listeners, you've heard it. And oh, by the way, in case the federal government is listening, don't turn off this podcast. But yes, we give our son medical marijuana regularly.
You're legal.
Yeah,
so
we're on a state level.
Don't worry,
we're legal.
Don't worry. But and New
don't
Jersey,
tell Jeff Sessions.
Well, New Jersey is on the cusp. So
oh, good.
Yeah. So I do want to do a.
Well, let's do an autastic episode
on
medical marijuana, because I think our listeners would be
so interested. So I do the topical versus the newsy. And then the other thing is there is opportunities. If you live near an autism center, congratulations. You can probably get great services. They also have research that you can participate in. But if you don't and you live, you know, in the middle of, you know, say you live in Flagstaff, Arizona, and there's not a good... you know, Autism Research Center, you can go online. You can participate in the Autism Research Network, or I'm sorry, the Interactive Autism Network. It's called IAN, and you can go to www.ianresearch.org. You can also participate in SPARC. You could Google SPARC.
There's SPARC for autism.org.
SparkForAutism.org.
Right.
And you can, you know, you can submit some information and get, you know, a gift card back and get even genetic information back if you're interested in that. Mm-hmm. And then also Autism Science Foundation has a list on our homepage of studies. Now, those are nationwide, but you can search them by location if you don't know if there's an autism.
And it's AutismScienceFoundation.org.
Right. Yes. And, you know, autism research is, we're also going to be launching a study that a survey that talks about why people participate in research and why they don't and what holds them back. And we want you, even if you've never participated in research before, to participate in that. So go to the website, and we'll definitely be soliciting your ideas. But it's the researchers are trying to give back as much as they get from you guys. So, you know, whether it's money or whether it's a psychological report that you can use to help fight for your, you know, your child's interests mm-hmm. on the educational level, whether it's, you know,
diagnostic information,
whether it's even a couple hours of respite, you know, mm-hmm. diagnostic information. So they try to give back as much as they kind of try to get. So there could definitely be benefits to participating in research.
Yes, participate in research, people. Well, Alicia, thank you so much.
Oh, thank
it was
you.
Great to talk to you.
This is
and
fun.
Everyone, listen to the Autism Science Foundation podcast, available on iTunes.
Yes.
And check out autismsciencefoundation.org.
Yes.
I hope you'll be back to share more with us.
I hope so, and we can talk about medical marijuana.
All right, signing off.
Well, that was it, Graham. What did you think?
Great. I learned a lot. And it's I don't know a lot about how research is funded and how things like that come about, and it's just interesting, you know, that people like this exist. She has a small office, but there's still an office working towards it. It's amazing stuff, and of course it's needed, and we appreciate it.
I felt like I thought it was very interesting to have two very smart women who are into science disagree about
the genes.
I think it's very insightful as to the whole conversation surrounding autism, that you can have smart, good-willed, intelligent, good-hearted people that just disagree on a basic level.
Yeah, do you remember? Remember when people could civilly disagree?
Let's not get into politics, but yes, I find it very encouraging when people that disagree on different things are able to have a civil discussion and make a point. Because Jill made a very valid point too about that only 10% of autistic people are being helped with genetics or could be helped with genetics, which is something that doesn't get pointed out a lot. That being said, the genetics is an important point. And then I thought when they touched on the environmental thing, they're both very smart. So they both had excellent points about Jill was like, you know, well, the correlation is weak. And then Dr. Holliday was like, yeah, but it's all in the same direction. And there's a lot of it. I thought it was a very, very interesting. Check out her podcast. It does not compete with ours at all. It is a science podcast.
Yeah, it doesn't overlap. You might learn something.
Not that much overlap. And Graham, where are you at this week? What's going on with you in your life?
I am going to be in Los Angeles, California, doing a bunch of shows, trying to sell a movie and a TV show. Got some meetings lined up. Big time Hollywood showbiz type guy over here.
Ooh, I like it.
Yep. And then I'll be back in New York for a week, and then I'm going to Europe to do some shows. So that'll be fun. I'll be in Paris and Berlin. You can find all my show times at comedybythegraham.com. Also, follow me at Instagram. On Instagram. Jesus. Shut up. I went to a concert last night and
Did you forget your own name or your own podcast?
Foggy.
What did you forget? Was it your own name or your own podcast? Be honest. I love you, Graham. Long-time listeners know Graham has had four different handles on his Instagram, and so he forgets what his handle is sometimes, which makes me laugh a lot.
I legit have early onset Alzheimer's, I'm pretty sure.
That's great.
I'm the first person to have it in their 30s.
That's great. Have a great time in Europe. I will be in New Westminster this weekend at Laugh Lines, and then Calgary. I'll be in Denver Monday, the 22nd, and then in Calgary for the weekend at Yuck Yucks. You can catch me. And follow me on
Denver to Calgary.
Yeah, the old milk run. Yeah, catch
you.
Kirk Smith Comedy on Instagram. Let's get those numbers up. I want a blue check mark too, just like Graham. and Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, blah, blah, blah.
That's it. You guys are great. Thanks for listening.
Have a great week,
Thanks,
guys.
Thanks, Jill Escher. Thanks, Alicia Holiday.
Thank you so much, guys. Have a great week. You can do it.